You know how life has seasons?
Yes.
Like for you, hunting season.
Yes.
Football season.
That's an important one.
That's a big one. So for me, I've kind of measured things in my life with the Olympic seasons, which are technically right. called quadrenniums. It's the period of 4 years between a game. So like summer games, you have four yeah. years, right? And if you're an Olympic athlete, you really measure it because each year you're doing something if you're hoping to get to another games to do that. So for me, like Athens games, 2004, I got married 3 weeks later. That was a big week. Torino games, 2006, I had a baby 12 weeks before. So if you ask me like these big life events, I usually remember it as to like what Olympics happened very closely to it. So when we get to the countdown to 1 year to an Olympics, for me, it's a little trigger that like fun work is about to start because I like following all these stories and local athletes. And this week we've hit the 1 year countdown. So TikTok.
Nice.
Tokyo 2020 coming up in a year. And this is going to be a good one. People are really excited about Tokyo. So today our guest is Kim Conley. She is a two-time Olympic runner. She runs the 5,000 meters.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of meters. It's 12 times around the track, roughly 3 miles. And Kim is hoping to get to a third Olympics in the same distance. So on this Dying to Ask, this Olympic countdown week, we'll talk to her about how being an Olympian changes your life forever. Because anytime somebody introduces you, they always say, she's an Olympian.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't say it to me, but like,
I think you get to like walk around and just play the Olympic theme song on your phone everywhere you go.
You could, but I don't know. People get judgy about that. We'll talk about the best and the worst things about making it to the U.S. Olympic team and how this time around she actually got the Olympic standard time, which is a big deal, a year early, kind of accidentally. She's not your typical runner. Her rise into running is not usually the path that people take to get there. But it's clearly worked because she's well on her way to representing Team USA for a third time.
Nice.
All right. All things Olympic. You think I geek out about books and running? Add in the Olympics and I'll be insufferable for the next 40 minutes.
This is going to be a treat. I can already tell.
I think you're going to have fun. We welcome Kim Conley to Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Kim Conley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. And, you know, we're here to talk about this being the kickoff to the 1 year before the Tokyo Olympics countdown. And just before we started, you were like, now, what is that Fred date? And I was laughing. I'm like, how am I telling you, the almost three-time Olympian, when the Olympics start? But the funny thing is that in your mind, it's another week because it's your job.
Exactly. Yeah. It's there's so many intermediate goals you put along the way. And so I have 2019 U.S. Championships coming up and then hopefully 2019 World Championships. And then from both my experiences making the last two Olympic teams, I know you can't take anything for granted. So the Olympic trials in 2020 is really where my focus is and hopefully punching my ticket to the Olympics.
And that's what's so weird about it is that the Olympic trials take place weeks before the actual Olympics. It's just crazy to me that that's how the system works.
Yeah, I mean, in a good way, it means you can do like one big peak for that entire summer. But it also makes it impossible to plan, you know, just, you know, for the sake of not jinxing anything, I would never let family book travel to Tokyo until I actually made the team.
Isn't that the wild? That's true. Most people they'll purposely tell their families, do not do it.
That's interesting.
I know. Huh. I know. But you know, in a weird way, I think that that's probably how a lot of people feel because you don't want to jinx anything.
No, I mean, I've heard stories of athletes that thought they were going to make it and, you know, had a VRBO booked in Rio and then had to cancel it. And that, you don't want to be in that situation.
You don't want to be in that. But then I guess...
Thought, like that thing in the back of your mind, like during the race, like, oh, well, I better do well because I've already paid a bunch of money, right?
Well, there probably would be, although I would imagine that in the race, all you're thinking about is what's right there in front of you. Right.
Yeah, well, see, good point. Ideally, you are just totally focused on what's right in front of you. So if you have that distraction of, you know, knowing that you've made plans and you start thinking about that in the race, then that's a bad sign.
All right. So 1 year out, you have a huge advantage over most of the people who are hoping to make it to the 2020 Olympics. And that is you did something last month, sort of kind of accidentally, that other people would just kill for right now. So tell us about what happened in the Netherlands.
Yeah, so June 9th, I was over in the Netherlands. So like I said, right now I've been focused on this year's U.S. Championships and World Championships, and the standard for that is 1522. The Olympic standard for next year is harder. It's 1510.
So breaking down, for people who aren't familiar with this, your specialty is the 5,000 meters, which is?
12 and a half laps, 3.1 miles.
Okay, so around a track. So cool. Around your football track in high school, that's how many times?
Cool. Three times. Three miles.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You ever done that, Jeff?
3 miles?
Yeah.
In one run?
Yeah. No. Okay.
Not without stopping.
Not without stopping. Kim does not stop for snacks. All right. So anyway, continue.
So I went to the Netherlands hoping to run under 15:22 to put myself in contention to make the world team this year. My training had been going really well, so I also had a feeling in a great situation. I could PR. My PR is 15:08. And it ended up being a really great race, and I had a really good battle on my hands. And I ran a 3-second PR. I ran 15:05, and I was just thrilled with that because I've been on this long comeback from an injury, and I've been racing for a year now and started at 15:49 and have just been chipping away. So it just felt like the culmination of, like, a really, really hard year of making this comeback, and I was thrilled to PR, and I was thrilled to get that world standard.
But you're focusing on what's in front of you, because
exactly.
That's what you do.
Exactly. And so then, celebrated a little with my husband and coach, Drew, and then went for my cool down. And then about 10 minutes into my cool down, I suddenly realized I have the Olympic standard now also.
Which is like kind of getting Wonka's golden ticket, because the Olympic standard, just putting in real layman's terms, like, you can come in top three at the Olympic trials, but if you don't have the Olympic standard, which is the minimum time to get into the Olympics, you don't get to go. So you've got that part of it out of the way, which is huge. So now, when it's time at the trials, you focus on coming in top three.
Yeah, exactly. So, this is much earlier than I've ever had the Olympic standard going into an Olympic trials.
Yeah. I mean, you did it like 10 seconds before last time around. It probably felt that way anyway.
Exactly.
So what's, like, for you as an athlete, like, what's the big advantage to that for you for the next year?
Well, it helps me plan out my schedule for next year. I'd also like to try to run the standard in the 10,000, which is 31:25. And the opportunities to run a good 10,000 are really few and far between. There just aren't many high caliber 10,000s on the track.
What makes for a high caliber 10,000? Jeff is appalled by the phrasing. I can tell. He's like, what?
So the 10,000, you're doubling the 5,000. So it's 25 laps.
So 6 miles and change.
Yes. 6.25 miles.
Nice math.
Oh. And it can get very lonely out there. So if you don't have company to run with, speaking for myself, I lose focus really easily and I'll just drift back and back and back and get way off pace. So what you want is to find those athletes from around the world that are going to be targeting a similar time and then to run in a pack and chip away at it. There aren't very many times when you get that like right group of athletes together. Usually it happens over at Stanford, which is very convenient for me.
That is for you.
You get, women from Japan and women from Australia and England and all over the country, like, coming together. And so I'd like to circle that next year at the beginning of May as my target for the 10,000. And so to have the 5,000 out of the way means just I can, like, focus on that for next year and then have the options going into the Olympic trials.
This may be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When you are looking for that group of people and you go into a competition, is it like an silent understanding that, hey, we're going to work together and we're going to try to push each other's point until it gets to the end? Or do you actually, like, have a conversation about it? Like, are there alliances? Is this like Survivor? Because I know, like, in cycling sometimes, you'll trade on. You lead for a while. Is it like that within running at those distances?
It can be. It's kind of a funny thing, because at a certain point in a race, and then certainly at a certain point in season, such as the Olympic trials or Olympics, like, that's all off. Like, you're going for top three, and it's purely competitive. So I would say for the most part, those conversations are actually left to coaches and agents to figure out, like, hey, this is the date we're going to circle, and let's, like, get a group of athletes together. And we just try to get in our zones and ready to compete hard.
It's so interesting. Do you talk right before you go? Like, do you have any, like, rituals right before you race?
Like with other athletes?
Yeah. Do you do anything?
No, you know, some athletes are like fine with warming up together. I like to warm up by myself, get into my zone. You know, if an athlete says like, hey, want to warm up together? I usually say like, I will cool down with you. But this is my time right now.
Want to stretch? That's fun. Once you finished the Rio Olympics, was it a given that you would continue on for, they call it the Olympics? I'm going to give you a little buzzy word here. The Olympic quadrennium.
Quadrennium.
So 4 years refers to the Olympic cycle, right, which is a long time if you think about it. Did you know automatically that that's something you would continue going for?
Yes. At the time, I was thinking I was going to expand my range up to the marathon. And that's still something I want to do. But just with the injury I had last year, I kind of ran out of time to really master the marathon. And I have unfinished business on the track. So I'm pretty happy right now staying focused on the track. And since I just PR'd, I feel kind of affirmed with that decision.
Oh, I'd say it's going just fine.
For those of us uninformed, what's the unfinished business?
Well, so I just ran 15:05 for the 5,000, and I want to break 15 so bad.
You too.
6 seconds to go. But I'm just not, I'm not ready to move on to the marathon without doing that. And I am a little bit afraid that I'd lose the speed I need if I focus so much on the marathon training.
Yeah.
So yes. Also, coming off Rio, I was really, really disappointed with my performance in Rio, and so I wouldn't be ready to move on from the sport either. I need to get back to that stage and have a better outcome.
What were you disappointed about?
Well, okay. So backing up a little bit.
When I was six.
Don't worry, not that far.
Yeah, how far back are we going?
So in 2012, I made the team, and it was really dramatic at the Olympic trials when I made it, and a shock, even to myself, really, that I made the team.
Describe why it was so shocking.
Well, so I actually went into that Olympic trials without the Olympic standard, and my PR at the time was 5 seconds slower than the Olympic standard, so I knew it was possible. I thought, there's another 5 seconds in me. I also felt like it was possible to contend for a top three finish, but to do both in the same race seemed improbable to most people. It was just a long shot, basically. And then,
can I stop you just for 1 second? I did an interview with John Mansoor, who is very well known in the USA track and field world and also out of this area. And we were doing a story previewing Kim going for it. And I did an interview where he was sitting on the edge. Do you remember this?
No.
Sitting on the edge of the Sac State track. And I said, what would it take for her to pull this off? And he said, and John is usually pretty darn right on all this stuff, as he will tell you. He said, she needs every star to align for this to happen. Every star to align.
Yeah.
And it did.
It did.
And it did. Because John was right.
He was right. He was right. And it just worked out that way. So I ended up, it came down to a really, really crazy battle between third and fifth place. And I leaned at the line and got third by 0.04 seconds. And I got under the Olympic standard by 0.21 seconds.
So. Isn't that crazy? And there's this picture. I don't know who took this picture, but it's amazing. Of like Kim like pushing her way through and everybody. What did everybody call it? Like the lean or the push?
Lean, yeah.
Man. Do you even, like when you get into something that dramatic, do you feel it? Or is it just instinct that takes over?
I would say it's instinct that takes over. Yeah. I mean, I've always enjoyed those really, really close battles, even just like messing around. When I coached at UC Davis and would run with the guys, we'd start sprinting when we saw the gate into the track and we'd lean at the line and, you know, we were just messing around. But in that moment, I could have been doing that again. But luckily I was at Hayward Field and it was the Olympic trials.
Luckily. And luckily nobody had bought tickets to London at that point.
Yes.
Because that obviously is what really put you over the edge. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, let's go ahead and go back in time, because I want to know how you really got into running, how you made the decision to become a professional runner, some of the lessons you've learned along the way as an Olympian, and then some of the weird stuff that goes on when you run at this level, because it's a really different kind of life that you guys lead. We'll be back with more Dying to Ask right after this. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record. You might have to help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts. How'd you get into running? Did you come from a running family?
Yeah, my dad, he ran in high school. He went to the first time they ever held the 2 mile at the state meet way back in the day. He was there. That was his senior year. And then I joined the Santa Rosa Express Trek Club when I was 12.
Which is where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Rosa.
Now, was your father, your mother's from England. Mm-hmm. Is your father also from England?
No,
is
he's from the Bay Area.
Oh, he was. Yeah. Okay, which is how you guys ended up there then.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. And so did people realize you were pretty good right away?
No, I was a decent overall athlete, but I wasn't the best distance runner on that youth track team, and I wasn't the best distance runner at my junior high school. And then certainly when I got to high school, we had a senior on the team, Sarah Bay, now Sarah Hall, who's also a professional right. runner, and she was a superstar. She won 4 state titles in high school. So yeah, I was like a good runner, but by no means a phenom, and certainly not somebody that ever thought would one day end up at the Olympics.
Twice.
Yeah.
Possibly 3 times. So at what point did it really click where people realize, oh, wait a minute, there's something else here?
Well, I just improved every year. I actually, it broke with an injury in 2015, but I had a 16-year PR streak where every year I was just making small gains, never the huge breakthrough that really like put me on a map. And that I wouldn't say that really happened until 2012 with that Olympic trials race. But I just improved year after year after year. And when I was graduating from UC Davis, I had a PR of 16:17 in the 5,000. So, you know, a minute slower than that Olympic standard.
Which is crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. But I loved running so much, and I really wanted to break 16 at the time. And so I just wanted to continue to pursue it just to see how good I could be. And so I just continued on that path of chipping away.
So what do you think it was, especially as a high school kid, if you weren't that name that everyone was talking about, which is interesting, you know, having had Sarah around you at that time too, to think of two people who'd become these huge names years later. What do you think it was about the sport that you liked so much that you kept working? Because a lot of people, if they don't see that success and they don't get that recognition early, kind of lose interest. I mean, I definitely see it with my kids. Like, they're like, oh, well, I guess I'm not good at this. Well, you've tried it for 10 seconds. So what was it about running that you just liked?
Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because the thing about running is you can always set personal bests. And so there is that kind of internal reward of, hey, I'm better than I was a year ago, and I'm putting all this work in, and I'm seeing the benefits of it. And you don't have to compare yourself to other people. Winning races is really fun. Like, I fully admit that. But you lose way more races than you win. And so I think if you can find the satisfaction in just improving yourself, then that's what keeps you going.
That's a good analogy for life too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then you ended up going to UC Davis. Why did you choose Davis?
I'd always really liked the idea of going to Davis. When I was in 8th grade, I asked for a bike for Christmas, declaring that I was going to take it to Davis one day.
I love that. For people who are listening in other parts of the country and our 2 Canadian listeners, who we always like to give extra attention to, UC Davis is a school located in Davis, California, which is about 10-15 minutes outside of Sacramento. And honestly, like we joke about the bikes, but like everybody rides a bike there.
They invented the bike lane.
Yeah.
Literally. They literally invented the bike lane.
But it's a really kind of special place.
Yeah, it is. So, and then they happened to be transitioning from Division II to Division I right when I was coming out of high school. And so they recruited me really hard, and that felt good. You know, I was also interested in Cal and UCLA, but they weren't interested in me. So, you know, it worked out that, you know, it was a really good match with Davis, and I was really happy there.
Exactly. So moving into kind of the Olympic time and making an Olympic team, what is it about the experience that is so worth it to people that they're willing to kind of go that direction in their life and maybe not go the other direction? Because at some point, every athlete at that level has to make the decision, do I go into kind of a quote-unquote normal life like the rest of us, or do I continue down the kind of professional athlete route, which is a completely different kind of lifestyle and commitment? So what was it about it that you really liked that you said, okay, I'm gonna continue?
You know, part of it is just that idea that you can continue to improve, that, you know, when you're graduating from college, you're not nearly at the peak of your potential as a distance runner. And so it was the idea that I still had a lot more in me. And then there's the aspect of getting to represent your country, which is so exciting. And the Olympics is the pinnacle of it all, but there are like stepping stones along the way to shoot for. So the first time I got to represent the U.S., it was called Chiba Ekiden, which is a race in Japan. And it's it's a mixed relay that covers a marathon, and I ran a 5K leg. There were guys that ran 5K legs or guys that ran 10K legs. They divided up into seven legs.
That is a wackadoodle race. That's a legit race.
Yeah, they're really cool. I wish they would come
and
here.
And you represented our country in this?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. Yeah, they have these sashes that you wear. Instead of holding like a baton, you wear the sash during the race, and then you have to practice like taking it off and handing it off.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. They alternate, like a male hands off to a female and she hands off to a male.
How do we not have that here?
I know. I think we should bring it to CIM.
Well, we should. We brought Ninja Warrior from Japan. Why don't we bring that?
Right.
Yeah.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
So it is interesting, all these different places and things that kind of open the door to going and running.
Yeah, exactly. So that was my mentality at first, you know, before when my 5,000 PR was a minute slower than the Olympic standard, I wasn't thinking about trying to go to the Olympics back then. I was thinking about getting to see the world, getting to put on a US singlet, and, you know, and just continuing to improve.
Yeah. What's the most remarkable thing about the Olympic experience for you? Like, do you remember getting out onto that track in London?
Oh, yeah. It was just, I mean, London was so special because the fans were just amazing. And it was so loud and packed with 80,000 people. Actually, one of the craziest moments, though, was as I came up the ramp into the stadium, and it was just like all encompassing this noise. And then I heard Kimmy. And I turned and saw a family that I knew from Davis.
No. Yes. That is so Davis.
I know.
That is amazing.
But yeah, I mean, the overall experience of the Olympics was just so cool. Another moment that just really stuck out to me was being in the Olympic Village and getting in an elevator and seeing a diver that had a gold medal around his neck. And, you know, it just like really hit home. Like, wow, I'm at the Olympics and I'm around, you know, not just track and field athletes, but all these sports, yeah, people from all over the world, and they're all the best at what they do. And it was really inspiring.
It seems like, you know, people go one way or the other there. You have some people who are so focused, nothing bothers them. And then you have some people who like are in the village or in that experience. And for a lot of them, it's the first time they've kind of had a little freedom and like some social time. And there are some people who go, and I'm sure you saw things, they go completely the other direction. And it's really hard to keep that focus during this one time that's so important.
Yeah. And yeah, because another interesting factor is the age range of athletes,
yes,
you know, because for some sports you peak so much younger. And so like you say, yeah, I mean, then they're in the village and it's all that freedom. Another really kind of weird little aspect to village life was because McDonald's is a huge sponsor of the Olympics. There's a huge McDonald's. And I would never eat McDonald's, yeah, like in training, let alone right up before the competition. And the line was huge.
Never gonna sponsor this show now. Thanks, Kim. No, I'm totally kidding. No, but you're right, because yeah, it is. It's like going into the college dorm for the first time, and you're like, I can eat anything.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting.
It's crazy. It's totally, I always say it's kind of like, the Olympics are kind of like Neverland, you know, Peter Pan, like nothing's real. Yeah. It's all temporary, and everybody's out to have a really, really good time, and yep, then in 2 weeks it all ends, and you're like, did that really just happen? But yeah, kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
What would you say has been the impact in terms of just your own personal life of having that Olympic experience? You know, there's the saying of once an Olympian, always an Olympian, but it is a real defining thing about you, because probably when people meet you or someone introduces you, probably the next line is, she went to the Olympics, right?
Yeah. I think for me it was, especially with that first team, the way in which I made qualified, and the journey to get there, it made me feel like I could do anything, you know, if I put my mind to it and put the right amount of effort into it. And one of my favorite moments coming after it was when I met somebody that told me that after my race, they were inspired to go to law school because they, like, it had been something they'd been hesitant about. They didn't really necessarily believe in themselves. And then after they saw my race, they were like, man, if she could do that, like, I can go to law school. And I was like, wow, that makes me feel so good, because, you know, sport can seem, I don't know, kind of selfish or trivial sometimes. But if somebody can get inspired in that way and then, like, put it to good use in their own life, I felt really good about that.
Isn't that crazy to think about? Somebody is like slaving away for 3 years studying law school books because you won a race. It's really wild. What did you study in college?
Exercise biology.
Really? So if you weren't doing this, what would you have been doing, do you think?
So the path of the time was to go to PT school and become a physical therapist. But I was already having second thoughts about that. And so when I graduated and decided to run, I also became an assistant coach at Davis. And at the time, you know, I was kind of doing both, thinking if by 2012 I haven't gotten a shoe contract and can really like fully be a professional runner, then I'm going to go full into coaching. And I loved coaching. So I think that's probably where I'll end up eventually.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take another break. You mentioned you got the shoe contract, and that's a critical part to being able to finance a life and a career doing this. So when we come back, when we talk about what a day is really like for you as a professional runner, how do you train, what goes into it, what you're doing this year that's maybe different than your last Olympic experiences. Oh, and then you also mentioned that your coach is also your husband. And that's an interesting dynamic as well, because I don't know about you, Jeff, but my spouse coaching me through anything does not go well a lot of the times. So clearly it takes a special relationship. Yeah. And we'll learn more about that right after this. Jeff, you know how when you plant a garden, you water it so it will grow?
In theory, mm-hmm. Yes. I've not done this myself.
Yeah, that's not how podcasts work, though. We need ratings and reviews, so please take a second when this episode finishes and leave us a quick review on Apple iTunes. I read all of them, and whoever ID'd themselves as L3SF and suggested that I slow down a little bit, you were right. So thanks for the feedback. Back to the show. I don't know if my husband could be my coach. I don't know about you, Jeff, but like sometimes it's hard to take instruction from those who are closest to you. You guys have such an interesting relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about being a professional runner is your entire lifestyle is dedicated to that pursuit. It's not like you say like, all right, I'm home from work and, you know, now whatever, like I'm, you know, I turn off that side of my life. It's what I'm always doing. It's kind of like part of who I am. And so we are sharing those goals together. And it's actually hard for me to imagine it any other way, because we're on that journey together, and he's dedicating his whole life to that pursuit, which I think would be really hard to ask of anybody else.
It would be, because I think, especially, you know, I would imagine it'd be challenging to be married to somebody who has nothing to do with the industry, because like you said, it is very much a 24/7, like decisions you make at 10 o'clock at night to not go to bed affect the next day.
Right.
Yeah. What's a day like?
Practice in the morning, usually around 9 o'clock, and it takes like 2.5 hours by the time we've done like a full dynamic warm-up, actually do the training session, and then do kind of like cool-down elements of it. And then 2 to 3 days a week, I am over at Elite Spinal and Sports Care here in Sacramento doing some kind of body work, like active release therapy. I see Dr. Lau, the chiropractor, and then they have 2 massage therapists there.
That sounds like, let me just stop for a second. Yeah. Like to most people, having to go to a massage for work.
Oh man, that's hard.
Sounds awful. Is it awful though, in a weird way? Like just because it is part of the job? It is work, right?
It's great. It really does make you feel so good. And when I'm not doing it consistently, then it's like everything starts to close up from my upper body to, you know, to my hips, my stride shortens. So,
don't you wish you'd applied yourself to running now? You could have been getting massages on the clock.
Oh, man.
Like, I will say, they're not some pleasant sessions.
Yeah.
It can be pretty painful.
How much do you sleep at night?
I usually sleep 8 to 9 hours, probably in bed for 9 hours. Mm-hmm. So
when was the last time you did that?
We'll move on. And you had mentioned, you know, you had mentioned in the last segment you were talking about, you know, getting a shoe contract. For professional runners, that's a really big deal. Like what's the significance of having these big sponsorships in terms of being able to like actually carve out a career doing this?
Yeah, I mean they are everything really in terms of carving out the career. It's a base salary with a bonus contract, and so the way any professional runner kind of cobbles together a living is through that endorsement deal, prize money, and appearance fees. But the endorsement contract, that's going to be your most consistent source of income, because prize money and appearance fees is pending health and success in races. And the appearance fee comes from success in other races that makes meet directors want you on their start line.
Yeah.
So having that shoe contract kind of just gives you some stability.
Do shoes show up at your house all the time? I mean, like, that's the assumption that most people have. Like, you get home, you're like, oh, wow, more new shoes.
Yeah. Shoes and clothes.
Sounds awesome. Sounds fantastic. What are your other, like, future goals? What else would you like to do? Obviously, you've got, you know, a third Olympic team coming up. But what are the other things that, like, you just like to do, maybe just to get away from running sometimes?
Yeah.
I would imagine that's kind of important as well.
So, like you said, like, right now, focus definitely on this Olympics and hopefully another Olympic cycle after that, moving up to the marathon. But there are lots of things that I don't get to do. And part of that is we're traveling so much that when, you know, in that like 2-week window I get once a year where I'm taking some downtime, like, I don't really want to get on the plane again and go somewhere. But there are lots of places in the world that I want to go back to and see. For example, I got to race in Rome a couple years ago, and I flew into Rome 2 days before the race, lay really low at the hotel, ran the race, got out the next morning, and I never saw the Colosseum. I never saw anything.
Nothing.
And that kills me. And I get to go to the Pan Am Games later this summer, but it's right in the middle of the season, and I can't believe I'm going to Peru and not going to Machu Picchu. Oh. So
that is kind of brutal.
Yeah.
Are there things that you can't do because you're a professional runner? And I'll give you an example. Like, I have a friend who used to race in the Tour de France, and as part of his contract, he wasn't allowed to do, like, all kinds of other athletic things like ski. And so when he was all of a sudden not cycling and he got to go back and ski, he was a crazy skier because he had all this pent up energy of, like, he had not been allowed to ski in case he would hurt himself. Do runners have similar kinds of things?
So not by the contract. Like the contract with New Balance basically says I have to race in a certain number of, like, IAAF sanctioned races a year. So then it's incumbent upon me to make sure I don't do anything like ski where I might get hurt and then violate the contract.
Right.
So I'm kind of constructing those own rules for myself. I would never go skiing, for example, or skateboarding.
Just personal self-preservation there. Absolutely. What's it like interacting with people who are fans of the running community these days? Because it's interesting. I see a lot of people who are kind of up and coming names in your field, and not necessarily the 5,000, but just runners in general. And they have these, like, wild social media followings. And so I'll think, oh, I should be following this person. And then I'll look, I'm like, well, they've got a huge social media following, but they don't actually have results. But there's this appearance that they are these huge, huge names. That seems like that has really changed a lot in the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, it definitely has. And that's the balancing act of, like, you know, doing what you need to do to be the best possible athlete you can be, and sharing the journey. But, you know, I guess at the end of the day, like, my goal is to get to the Olympics and perform well at the Olympics. And I want my social media following to just be, like, a byproduct of that. I don't spend a lot of, like, energy investment to just developing the social media following for the sake of having that following.
That said, she has a nice following. She does have a healthy following. Is it weird to you sometimes, and maybe I see this too, but I'll see people, like, pretty big name athletes who list out every part of their workout on social media, and I think, is that really what they did all day? Are those really the results they posted? It's amazing how much some people share.
Yeah,
as part of the process, you know?
Yeah, it is interesting. And it just, like, runs the gamut in terms of, like, some people are, like, really secretive, and then some people share everything. Because I coached, I have that little coach side of my brain that gets, like, worried about, like, don't try this at home. Like, just trying to be responsible with, right, like, what I'm sharing so that nobody, like, misunderstands anything. You just never know. You would want somebody to, like, not just, like, take what they see you doing and then try it themselves if it's not, like, the right type of training for them.
That just reminded me, a few months back, I was training for a marathon, and the funny thing about Kim and other runners is you never know where you're going to see an Olympic athlete, right? So, like, for example, you train on a local high school track, mm-hmm. which is, like, bananas because people around you are like, she's a pretty good runner. I'm like, yeah, she's gone the Olympics a couple of times. But the other place you spend a lot of time training is the American River Bike Trail, where lots of like people like me go out as well. And then all of a sudden, you know, you see these like incredibly accomplished people going by. So a few months back, I'm just running like a Saturday or Sunday morning. And you go by me and you're so sweet. You always like say hi and I see you and your husband Drew. So we chat just like for a second as she's going by and then like, I want to see how long I could hang in. So I sped up and this is what I said to her. I said, don't slow down. Just keep going. I just want to see how long I can go. And it was like 29 seconds. And I paid for it for like the next 4 miles trying to get back to the house. Am I the only person who's done that to you, or do you get that happening?
It's not the first time it's happened. It doesn't happen a lot.
It won't be the last time I do it either, so you know.
But yeah, it definitely happens occasionally. But more often what happens is a cyclist coming along and letting me know what my pace is, or just, you know, just wanting to know what I'm doing out there.
That's actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
Do you like the support of having, because you kind of based yourself out of this community, so not too far from where you went to college and where you had originally coached. Is it nice to have a home base when you do so much traveling?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love it here, and I always feel like I do my most effective training when I'm in Sacramento. So this is definitely like, you know, what I consider the base, and where kind of all the most important work happens.
What do you want your legacy in running to be?
Well, I mean, I definitely want to be a 3-time Olympian. and then, yeah, I want to go back into the coaching scene. And I think because of my journey and because, you know, I wasn't that superstar talent from the beginning and that I learned how to maximize my potential and bring out everything I could on myself, I just really like the idea of helping other athletes to do the same.
You were often called the underdog because of that first Olympic birth that you talked about. And actually, there was a biography that's been written about you that's coming out too.
Yeah, that's right. Hopefully later this summer it's written and we're just kind of in the final kind of tweaking stages of it. And I guess what's hard about it is the longer the process takes and the more content there seems to be because
yes.
My career's still going.
You're a pretty private person. Was that a difficult thing to take part in for you?
Yes and no. Yes.
Yes and no, and mainly yes.
It was like when so it's written by Tom Flynn, who's a writer that's followed me for 5 years now. And so when he first proposed the idea, the answer was a very automatic yes, because it's so flattering, you know, to have somebody that wants to tell your story. But so at the same time, like, it was also hard to do because I opened up so much and I went through journals from junior high all the way to present day and sent him anything that had to do with running.
Wow.
And so he really got an in-depth look into that side of my life.
What was the most embarrassing thing that came up from the junior high times?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I didn't send him anything. All the boy stuff I didn't.
You kept the juicy stuff out.
Yes.
What's the big thing you hope that especially young female readers get from your story?
I think that if you put the right effort into the sport, then you're going to see results, and that's the beauty of being a distance runner is you get out what you put into it, and so you can set goals and then you find those stepping stones and can work to achieve them.
I think that's very true of just life in general too. You know,
it is.
Even if running is not your thing, we've all got that thing that goal that's out there that maybe other people don't even think you can do, and it's sure as fun to prove them wrong sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely. Jeff, any final thoughts?
Earlier you mentioned your mother is English, is that correct? So could you technically represent England in the games?
What a great question, Jeff.
Yes, I could have. Now it would be hard. I've represented the U.S. And so there would be a waiting period where you're not allowed to represent either country.
Okay.
And, you know, to be completely honest, like the way you make the Olympic teams in England is – it's a little bit more of a political process. They just select a team.
It's really different.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, it's very
so
different.
So I really like the U.S. system. I like feeling like on one day you show up and you earn your spot on that team. Yeah.
And it's either a heartwarming or a heartbreaking time because literally it's the best of the best on that one day. And if you're having an off day,
Bad day to have an off day.
It's a bad day to have an off day. But you haven't had any of those, so we're not going to.
No. Well, I mean, 2016, my shoe came off in the 10,000.
Oh, that's true. That did happen. I forgot about that. Forgot about that. That is a true story. If you should Google the picture, it's really something, it's really something else. Well, Kim, best of luck here in the next year.
Thank you.
And it's really fun to catch up with you. You've been one of my favorites to follow over the years. And we always end up having great conversations about books, usually whenever we're interviewing. Usually there's a point where like, oh, forgot about the Olympics. But anyway, it's great to catch up with you. And congrats on being able to make that time so far in advance. And
thank you.
I hope everything just goes exactly the way you want it to go. Double knot those shoes.
Yes.
That can't hurt. And we hope that we will be seeing you in Tokyo next summer.
Thank you so much.
So I was kind of interested to hear her story. It kind of reminded me of a combination of like the American dream and an underdog story. Just how she was never the top of her class or anything like that. It was just kind of small chunks in that
yeah.
If you really want to, if you have the goal, then you can make it happen.
So it's funny you say that because the name of the biography that's coming out is Underdog.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, and I know you didn't know that. So that's great that you got that out of it. Yeah, she is. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of Olympic athletes over the years, and Kim is very understated. If you ran into her in the grocery store, you would not know that's what she does. She would never tell you that that's what she does. You know,
yeah.
She's very modest, very humble, and very grateful for the opportunities that have come her way. I mean, she's really just a lovely individual.
So yeah.
Be exciting to see what happens here for her in the next year.
Right.
So you can follow along on her Instagram journey. You'll find Kim at KF Conley if you want to follow along, and her husband/coach/personal photographer, Drew, as you heard, takes a lot of those pictures, and she's very interactive with people too. So if you have questions about what she's doing, I'm sure she would share with you. So check that out.
Thanks.
And then in the meantime, you can always keep up with us. You'll find me on Instagram at RunRateSip.
You can find me at Producer Jeff.
That's right. And then the show at Dying to Ask Podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
1 year to the Olympics.
Getting close.
So excited. Always. All right. We'll see you next time on Dying to Ask.
Bye.